Hello and welcome to The Wire, your national and independent coverage of current affairs right across Australia on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Tony Pank-Lewick, coming to you from Radio 4EB in Mianjin, Brisbane. And today on the show,
we have created a list of 23 companies with enormous coal, oil and gas expansion plans that should be denied finance from the big four banks going forward. And this includes companies like Santos.
A new report shows the four big banks are still supporting fossil fuel projects. We have all the details. Also, a report shows half of the price of a household is just taxes. Why is it so high? And later today,
it had structures on its clypeus, which is the bee's face, these devil-like horns. And when I was identifying all the specimens I collected, I realized this was one that hadn't been described.
An Australian scientist discovered a new native species of bee. We find out how. We'll have this and more for you over the next half hour. Thanks for being with us today. We're on air across Australia thanks to the Community Radio Network and the support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. First up today, with the 50th anniversary of the dismissal of former Prime Minister Gough Whitlam, it brought some reflections across Australians, especially from those who weren't alive at the time. Some unique events at the time resulted in the federal government nearly running out of money and the Governor-General stepping in to dismiss the former PM. Political reporter from CRN, Noah Secum, looks at these events and started speaking with 1RPH's volunteer, Marianne Gore, who shared her memories about the event.
I don't know how we got to know about it, but we certainly did. Maybe somebody had a radio, but we knew what was going on. All my school friends were on the Labor side, whereas I could see the other side because my parents have a small business. We have Project Lighting, which is a lighting retailer and electrical wholesaler. And we started in 1972, and all the public servants were starting to be brought from Melbourne to Canberra, and some from Sydney too. The population in the 70s in Canberra was just growing exponentially. And we were doing quite well because we were supplying the light fittings, Bakelite cable for their houses. At school that day, all my friends were saying how terrible it was and what an injustice it was that Whitlam was, in their words, booted out. But from my side, what had led up to that was the blocking of supply in the Senate. So the government was looking like it was going to run out of money. And the implications of that for the public servants who were buying their lights from us were really dire. So our small business was feeling the peril of that, and it was getting closer and closer to when the government was going to run out of money and the salaries of the public servants weren't going to be paid.
It's interesting to hear that the big concern was like an economic matter of life for you and your family. Do you think it would have mattered who was in that position as to whether or not that would have been the biggest concern of a blocking supply, possible dismissal?
No. If it had happened to the other side, it would be the same thing, yes.
Obviously, we look back as the dismissal day as this massive event in politics, but can you recall the weeks and months afterwards, whether it was just another piece of the news?
For some people, yes, it was. It did linger and they felt injustice had been done for quite a while. But other things happened when we turned over to have quite a large majority elected with the Fraser government. The economy really took off a bit. That exposed people to the fact that regular government is a stable force for the economy.
Mike Lewis is another person who shared a very personal reflection of how this monumental moment impacted an individual.
The reason that I was on the steps of Old Parliament House on the 11th of November 1975 was that I had lost my job in Darwin. My job was with the Bureau of Statistics, and I was responsible for household surveys. And there were no households left to survey in Darwin, and so the Bureau of Statistics had to find me another job. And so they sent me to Canberra. And I arrived in Canberra around about September of 1975, and I didn't have much money. And come November, I was really concerned that I wasn't going to get paid. And I was wondering how I was going to do without that money. So that was the reason why I was on the steps of Parliament House on the 11th of November.
And just to that point, were you actually not getting paid at all for the whole time you were in Canberra to that point?
No, I had been receiving my fortnightly salary, but the constitutional crisis was that the government had run out of money and it was blocking supply, and they were forecasting that the public servants would no longer be paid. And so I was really concerned about that as I was driving around Canberra.
And so the other thing, especially that we've heard today, is that there are a series of things that kind of led to November in 1975. Especially in Darwin, having witnessed the cyclone come through the year before, how much was federal politics really on your mind?
Well, I took an interest in the reconstruction of Darwin. Gough Whitlam appeared in Darwin at the time that I was there before I got evacuated. And so I took a little bit of interest in that. My main motivation was about making sure I got paid.
Obviously. I guess looking at Gough Whitlam's dismissal, has it still stuck out as a unique moment, considering that we've seen quite a churn of prime ministers since?
It's something that I'll never forget, just because it's been so historic. And it's just something that, you know, I was there on the day, and it was a big moment in the history of Australia.
Mike Lewis there, speaking with CRN's Noah Seckham. For these stories and more about politics, check out From Pillar to Post, wherever you get your podcasts. A new research from Market Forces shows Australia's big four banks have provided more than $43 billion to major coal, oil and gas projects over the last decade. The report also shows there are 23 existing fossil fuel clients they need to be excluded from further financing. Market Forces analysed as well how much money the big four banks are slashing to fulfil their commitments on not funding fossil fuel projects. The Wire's Eduardo Jordan started asking Head of Research at Market Forces, Carl Robertson, what the report entails.
This new analysis by Market Forces has found that in the decade since the Paris Agreement was adopted to rein in climate change, Australia's big four banks, ANZ, NAB, Commonwealth Bank and Westpac, have provided over $43 billion to the world's major coal, oil and gas companies, the vast majority of which still have no plans to phase out fossil fuels or aren't planning to increase their production.
As you mentioned, the report shows 23 companies are supporting, you know, are supported by the big four banks. Could you please expand a little bit on this?
So as of October 1st this year, the big four banks all require some of their fossil fuel clients to produce emissions reductions plans aligned with the Paris Agreement. Now, we have created a list of 23 companies with enormous coal, oil and gas expansion plans that should be denied finance from the big four banks going forward. And this includes companies like Santos, Woodside, BHP, and other overseas power generators such as JERA and GE Vernova.
So according to the report, the biggest funder of fossil fuel projects at the moment is ANZ. What do we know about their plan to stop funding these projects, and why have we not seen any progress on this?
ANZ has consistently been the biggest funder of fossil fuels and fossil fuel expansion in Australia over the past decade. Despite having numerous chances to deliver on its climate commitments, it has routinely opted to pass through policies that allow it to continue financing companies that have no intention of transitioning away from coal, oil and gas. And this continues even one decade on from the Paris Agreement.
Is there any bank or any institution that has really decreased their funding into fossil fuel projects? Is there any positives about this report?
We have seen substantial changes from particularly Commonwealth Bank in the last 4 years to stop financing companies expanding fossil fuels. And that is reflected in the fact that they have only accounted for 6% of overall fossil fuel finance in the last 4 years. We've also seen a lot of progress from NAB, who has come down from accounting for over 40% of fossil fuel finance just a few years ago to less than 9% so far in 2025. So some good news stories with Commonwealth Bank and ANZ, Commonwealth Bank and NAB, but ANZ and Westpac continue to be major sources of concern, accounting for over 80% of lending since 2024.
Now, could you please expand a little bit more on the economic and housing impacts if these banks continue to support these projects?
The big four Australian banks control about 80% of the Australian mortgage market, meaning that most Australian homes are within their portfolio. And we know that there are enormous risks to Australia's housing market in high warming scenarios, which is what we are currently heading for. So the big four banks continuing to finance companies that are fueling climate change and fueling worsening floods, heat waves, bushfires and cyclones is reckless business. And it is also extremely dangerous to the Australian population who own these homes.
Okay. And what has market forces done to let the banks know they need to fund other projects or, you know, stop fossil fuel projects funding? And what do you expect after they read this report?
For the last decade, market forces has worked with bank customers, shareholders, community members, scientists, and even institutional investors to hold the banks to account for their commitments to the Paris Agreement and to get them to direct their substantial financial resources away from companies fueling climate change and towards the solutions of climate change, such as renewable energy projects. After they read this report, we hope that the banks understand that their time for funding companies with no plans to transition is up, and they need to start funding companies and projects that are aligned with a transition to a safe and secure economy.
Kyle Robertson from Market Forces there, speaking with The Wire's Eduardo Jordan. You're listening to The Wire, independent current affairs on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Tony Pankluik in Brisbane. A big hello to our friends in Alice Springs on 8CCC, to our listeners in Hobart on Print Radio Tasmania, and to the other side of the country to Radio Goolari in Broome, Western Australia. The Housing Industry Association released its 2025 report on taxation of the housing sector, revealing up to half the cost of a new home in Sydney, Melbourne, and Brisbane comes from government taxes, fees, and charges. The report produced by the Centre for International Economics shows Brisbane recorded the biggest increase since 2019, up a staggering 106%. To unpack what this means for housing affordability and future growth, The Wire's Azucena Carrasco spoke with the Housing Industry Association's chief economist, Tim Reardon.
The HIA report argues that Australia's housing crisis can't be fixed without reducing the tax and regulatory load. And to go directly to an example, the report shows Brisbane has overtaken Sydney and Melbourne in terms of increased taxes and charges on new housing. We are talking about a jump of 106% since 2019. And to give some perspective to our listeners, Sydney has increased by 38%. So what is happening in Brisbane? Is there any combination, unique factors compared to other capitals?
That's right. The rate of increase in the cost of a new house and land package in the southeast corner of Queensland in particular has been increasing faster than anywhere else in the country because of the cost of land, and particularly due to the cost of taxes, fees and charges that are inbuilt into that cost of land. Of particular importance is how long it takes to turn greenfields land into shovel-ready land for new home development. In Sydney, 49% of the cost of a new house and land package is taxes, fees and charges. And that's because it takes 10 to 20 years to bring new greenfields land from a farm through to shovel-ready land ready to have a home being built on it. And it only takes then about 6 months to build the home on it. Mm-hmm. And what we've seen in Queensland over the past 5 years is that time frame to go from shovel-ready land to completed land has expanded. And because there is a limited urban growth boundaries within that southeast corner of Queensland, the price for each individual block of land is rising as well, which means that governments make more and more revenue out of sale through stamp duty, GST and other components that are imposed on the development of new land.
Right. So it seems that it is not that easy to explain in simple terms what is it that it is happening in Australia with so much land that we have, and basically we are struggling to build affordable houses.
The key issue is who pays to make water flow uphill. For every new development, either water or sewerage has to flow uphill at some stage, and it's expensive to build that infrastructure. Historically, that the cost of that infrastructure was paid for out of consolidated revenue. And then we moved to a user-pays model, and then we moved to a system of taxing the provision of that infrastructure, which means that those households moving into a new greenfield suburb or brownfields development don't pay for 100% of the cost of the development. They pay for 100 to 200% of the cost of the infrastructure to develop that land. If we're to address this housing shortage, we need to see governments making longer-term views, recognising, of course, that they make revenue out of developing new land. It costs them up front, but they recover that cost over the course of the next 25 to 30 years. But they build that infrastructure without charging the first households that move into a new greenfields development site.
If the situation continues like this, what's the expected outcome in the construction and housing sector for the next decade?
The key issue here is the time frame. It's very difficult to lower stamp duty and GST imposed on a house. Certainly, state and local councils can lower their fees and charges that are imposed on top of GST and stamp duty. We're still largely fixed with those two, stamp duty and GST. But by lowering the time frame, bringing more land to market, and the time from which it goes from dairy farm to shovel-ready land is reduced, that reduces the cost to those that are moving in. What we can see is that in South Australia, for example, it typically takes 4 to 6 years to bring greenfield lands to market. In the case of Sydney, that's almost 20 years. In the case of Brisbane, that's getting well beyond 10 years now to bring new greenfields land to market. It's that time frame that's the key issue.
Right. Okay. And just to go around the world a little bit, so there is an array of approaches in the housing industry.
One of the reasons we're building so few homes in Australia is because state governments have forced foreign investors out of the Australian market. Now, those foreign investors that build apartment complexes around the world are no longer able to build apartments in particularly Brisbane, Sydney and Melbourne. Mm-hmm. As a consequence, we've seen the number of apartments commencing construction fall by half. Mm-hmm. If we want to get to the goal of building 1.2 million, we need to see at least a doubling and preferably a tripling of the volume of apartments commencing construction. To do that, we're going to need access to overseas capital. Mm-hmm. We're not seeing domestic superannuation companies or mum and dad investors step in to fill the gap of those missing investors. Mm-hmm. And we're not talking about individuals that have ever come to Australia. We're talking about foreign institutions such as overseas-owned banks, Bank of America, Bank of Japan. Those types of institutions are now prohibited from investing in apartment building in Australia.
That was Tim Reardon from HIA, speaking with The Wire's Azucena Carrasco. A scientist in Western Australia has discovered a new Australian native species of bee. Dr. Kit Prendergast, the native bee scientist who made a discovery, chose the name Megachile hachirippus, Lucifer, for the bee in reference to its devil-like black horns. The Wire's Meave Groom asked Dr. Prendergast what the moment was like when she realised she had discovered an entirely new bee species.
So it was back in 2019 when I was asked to survey a critically endangered plant in the goldfields for its pollinators. So this plant, we didn't know what visited it and potentially pollinated it. And a bee that I collected from this plant, as well as on the mass flowering eucalypts, a little Maui called Eucalyptus libida that was in flower at the time, it had these really cool structures on its clypeus, which is the bee's face, these devil-like horns. And when I was identifying all the specimens I collected, I realised this was one that hadn't been described. And that was quite exciting, but also not that unusual, because there are many undescribed species of Australian native bees. But I decided that this bee was very distinctive, and given it visited this critically endangered plant, I was going to make it my mission to scientifically describe it so it could have a name and so that we could learn about it and raise awareness about it.
Apart from the horns that you described, what else makes this new bee species unique? What sets it apart from other species of Australian bees we already know?
Yeah, so the particular shape of the horns is very distinctive, and also a diagnostic feature for many bee species is the shape of the male reproductive parts, and essentially like the shape of the last segment on the male bee's abdomen, sort of his butt, a different shape to the other male bees in this subgenus Hacriapus. Another, you know, distinguishing feature for all species is they all have a unique DNA or genetic signature, and I was able to confirm that as well with DNA barcoding.
How long does it usually take to confirm something is a new species?
It involves quite a lot of detective work. So you read the published descriptions of related species, go to the museums to check that it hasn't been collected before, and, you know, if you're describing new species and you look at those specimens that are undescribed and include them in your description. So going to museums, and nowadays it's quite important as well to include the genetics, so DNA barcoding it, which involves taking a little bit of tissue with bees, it's part of a leg, and then sending that off for DNA barcoding, so the genes are sequenced in this particular gene called the CO1 gene. So, yeah, it's a lot of work, and then the way you write up a species description, there's a lot of measurement, so a lot of macro photos and taking measurements and looking at the bee under the microscope and any identifying features and writing it up, sort of a particular formula for new species descriptions. So it's a lot of work.
And you've mentioned in your writing that there are still hundreds of Australian native bee species still unidentified. Why do so many remain undiscovered?
Two issues. One is that there is very little funding into Australian native bee taxonomy. There's no permanent native bee taxonomy positions, paid positions, and very little funding available. And, you know, to describe this species, I had to apply for grants from the Goldfields Environmental Management Group, which I'm very grateful for.
And I guess my final question would be, are there regions of Australia that are biodiversity hotspots for some of these undiscovered species?
I think that there's many areas in Australia that haven't been surveyed for native bees yet. Australia is such a big continent with many remote areas, and so I have no doubt that there's many parts of Australia that there are undescribed species, and potentially even species that we haven't collected before. Also species that might fly really high up in the canopies of trees, which are very hard to survey and sample. So a lot of discoveries to be made.
That was native bee scientist from Curtin University, Dr. Kit Prendergast, speaking with The Wire's Meave Groom. And that's the end of the show today. Thanks so much for listening, wherever you are in Australia. The Wire is a co-production between community radio stations 2SER, Radio Adelaide, 4ZZZ, and Radio 4EB in Melbourne and Brisbane, with the great support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation and the Community Radio Network. We'll see you next week. Same time on your local station. And if you'd like to hear any one of our stories again, you can go to our website at thewire.org.au. The Wire acknowledges the traditional custodians of the Turrbal and Yuggera countries where this program has been produced, and we pay our respects to Aboriginal elders, past, present, and emerging. Today, The Wire came to you from Radio 4EB in Brisbane. I'm Tony Pankaluik. Thanks so much for your company. We'll see you next time on The Wire.